We are going to explore what it means to be a fan, how fandom has changed over time, what super fandom is, and how our obsessions change what we buy and who we are. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We are going to talk with the co-authors of the book, Super Fandom, how our obsessions are changing what we buy and who we are. And we are going to welcome your questions and your experiences. What are you a fan of? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. For some of us, being a fan means lining up outside a bookstore in order to get our hands on that new book at midnight. For others, it's being huddled around a TV or at a basketball court and watching something like this.
Oh, they double-teamed him. Wisconsin will go to New York City. They have knocked out the defending national champions. And the Badgers end this game on a 15-5 run.
So that was the Wisconsin Badgers defeating top-seeded Villanova, the top-seeded team in the NCAA basketball tournament and advancing to the Sweet 16 as they did this weekend. So a shout-out to the Badgers for that big upset win. But are you a big Badger fan? Are you a big Harry Potter fan? Are you a fan of something else? We'd love to hear from you as we talk with our guests. Let me welcome our guests. Zoe Fraud Blonner is a faculty member of New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program and NYU Journalism. She is co-founder and the CCO of the crowdsourced toy company Squishable, and her husband is also with us, Aaron M. Glazer, co-founder and the CEO of Squishable. He previously worked as a consultant and a journalist. They are the co-authors of the book Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. And they join us from the Argo Studios in New York City. Good morning. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Good morning, Joy. We're glad to be on the show.
Yeah, and you know, when I think of super fandom, I guess I do think of people who are sports fans, like the Badger fans who are celebrating this morning. But it means more to be sports is just one aspect of super fandom, isn't it?
It is. In today, everyone is a fan of something is one of the basic concepts that we came to when we first started writing this book. Sports fandom is something which is very low stigma. You can say that you're a sports fan and no one's going to make fun of you, usually. But we're all fans of something. It might be a celebrity, it might be a piece of media like Harry Potter, or it might be something completely random like a credit card or a product or, your hair gel. It doesn't matter necessarily what it is that people build their fandom around. Pretty much any piece of pop culture could act as a nexus for these very deep personal feelings of fandom.
So, following up on that, why would someone make fun of me for being the fan of something?
In the past, being a fan had a lot of associations with, fanaticism. That's where the term comes from, with being over the top, maybe loving something too much. It was acceptable to listen to music in a intellectually moderated way. It wasn't acceptable to throw your underthings at the composer. And this is a very ancient human urge to pay tribute to these things that we love, to form into groups around these things that we have in common with each other. And it's true that over time, this may have gotten a bit of a bad rep, but this has changed. Over the last 15, 20 years, we've seen a real revolution in how people see both fandom and the fans themselves.
Yeah, Aaron, why do we become fans of things in the first place?
So there's this deep base emotional human urge to have connected with products and people that we have emotional ties with. And part of what fandom is about is almost serving the same need that your community or your religion has served in the past, in that what you're looking for is something where you can associate with other people and where you can feel this deep emotional response to something that you love. And you're looking for products or items or media that reflect what your own core values are, that allow you to find other people who share those values and express them through your love of that thing.
Yeah. How much conscious control do we have in choosing what or who we like?
Very little, actually. In hindsight, people usually claim some kind of agency over what they chose to be a fan of. We'll make up reasons. We'll say, oh, I became a fan of Star Wars because I like their message of exploration and egalitarianism. But in the moment, that probably wasn't the case. What actually brings people to their fandom is most often more of a life cycle event, actually. They may have been in a period of transition or instability or growth when they were looking for pieces of culture that would help them become a better them. And this was the piece of culture which filled that hole, which helped them to fulfill that part of themselves. So we often see big explosions in fandom when people move, for example, when people are in their teenage years. So they're feeling all those deep feelings of where do I belong and how can I make my way in the world. When changing jobs, when going to school for the first time, maybe when having a child for the first time, these are all great periods of transition when folks really branch out and find new fandoms to help take them to the next part of their lives.
Yeah, let's talk about different levels of fandom. I mean, I'm a fan of the Wisconsin Badgers. I'm a fan of the Green Bay Packers. I'm a fan of a lot of different things, but I'm not. I mean, I like them. What defines being a fan? Is that just it? I like something.
Being a fan is different from being a consumer. In the book, we actually build a lot on this concept. To love something, that's wonderful, but to be loyal to a product or a piece of media, to love it, that's great, but that's the definition of being a loyal customer. Being a fan is different. Fandom requires doing non-commercial undertakings, the things that weren't actually intended in that original purpose. So if all I do with, say, Tide with bleach, if all I do with it is use it, then I'm a very loyal fan no matter, mm-hmm. Or rather a loyal customer, even if I use it all the time, even if it's my favorite type of detergent. But if I decide to start going on message boards and tell other people to use it, and maybe I start collecting the bottles, and maybe I petition the company to start changing the color to pink, well, then I start getting into fandom territory. Ah. So it's this section of, we call them the fan-like activities. It's things that people can do to prove that they're more than just customers.
And Aaron, how does fandom turn into super fandom?
It has a lot to do with kind of what we posit as our super fandom equation, which is to create a set of super fans, you have to have three core things available. First, you have to have a product that engages with their emotions. So you have to have something where people are emotionally tied to the product. You have to first then set up a platform where they can be super fans. So online, that can be something as simple as a Facebook page, or it can also be the stadium where you go and watch the Wisconsin Badgers play. And then you need a core minimum viable group of people to become super fans. Fandom doesn't exist in isolation. If you read the Harry Potter books at home, you can be a very loyal consumer of Harry Potter, but you're not really a fan because you have to be out there performing fan-like activities to be a fan.
That's what I was going to say. So I have to go to the Harry Potter festival, or I have to wait in line at the bookstore for the latest Harry Potter book.
You do, or you at least have to go on a Harry Potter message board and start talking with other people about what Harry Potter means to you or what house you might actually be selected into.
Yeah. So, Aaron, what are you a fan of? Or do you consider yourself a super fan of anything?
I do. I have several things. I have been for the last probably decade a super fan of Starwood Hotels, which is definitely not a commercial placement since I don't have anything to do with them. But I've actually found myself unintentionally going out and doing things like going on and figuring out where the best hotels that they have that I could use my points to stay are, or going and booking into a hotel so I can get to the next status level so I can get my fancy ambassador level for the next year. None of it really matters. I don't actually travel that much. But there's something about that that's created a loyalty in me and that I've tied my own kind of sense of identity to that makes me a fan of that.
Wait, I don't even know what this is. So there are hotels that are Star Wars hotels?
Starwood. I'm sorry.
Starwood,
W and Westin and those type of
properties. I apologize.
Properties.
I just misunderstood. I thought, wow, what kind of hotel chain is that?
Ooh, well, yes. And on the other side of that, part of what we talk in the book is that people come in and out of fandoms a lot. So I found myself in the last 6 or 7 months becoming a very strong fan of Westworld, where I actually would go on the Reddit message boards and track down all of the various fan theories. Because of this last couple of months, we've been working very hard on the book, and it's been a very stressful time. And it's been a way for me to find something I really engaged with, become very curious about, and want to involve because it was a very interesting message for me to explore at what was a fairly stressful time in my life.
Yeah. And what about you, Zoe? What are you? Are you a super fan of anything?
Golden Age murder mysteries. I love them. Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, they're just the best, and I am willing to tell anyone at very great length loudly, which is where the fandom comes in.
We are talking about super fandom, and we're welcoming your questions for our guests. We're welcoming your own experiences. Do you consider yourself a super fan of something? What is it about that something that has you so enraptured? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are talking with the co-authors of the book Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. This is the Ideas Network.
Excuse me. Who are you?
Rubeus Hagrid, keeper of keys and grounds at Hogwarts. Of course, you'll know all about Hogwarts.
Sorry, no.
No? Blimey, Harry, didn't you ever wonder where your mum and dad learned it all?
Learned what?
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard. And a thumping good one, I'd wager, once you trade up a little.
No, you've made a mistake. I mean, I can't be a wizard.
That's a clip from the film Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And we are talking about why so many people are fans of Harry Potter or something else with our guests who are the co-authors of the book Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. Zoe Fraud-Blonner, faculty member of New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program and NYU Journalism, and Aaron Glazer, co-founder and CEO of Squishable. And let's ask our listeners to join us with what are you a fan of at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So, Zoe, what can we learn from Harry Potter fans?
Harry Potter in specific is a great example. So many people came to Harry Potter fandom when they were in their very early teens or preteens. And this is, I think we mentioned, a very successful time for fandom because so much in our lives is completely out of control. We don't have any control over our schedules, our social lives, even our bodies. And these sort of stories, what has kind of come to dominate young adult fiction now, these stories of exceptionalism, of young people who all of a sudden discover that they are not the overlooked, bullied underlings that they think they are. Actually, they're a secret princess or celebrity or wizard or alien or angel or god figure. These stories are very important because they have this message of power and control during this period when people have very little of either. And Harry Potter really hits that sweet spot perfectly. The story of you feel like the world's against you, which is how we all feel in our teenage years, and yet, little do you know, it's going to get so much better and the world's going to love you and you're going to be popular and there'll be a love triangle. So this is a classic for a reason. It really managed to nail that formula perfectly. Yeah. There's no wonder that people were so drawn to it.
Yeah. Carrie on Facebook asks, when does a fan become a nerd and vice versa? Also, is there a limit to the number of things or people that one can be a super fan of? How about that, Aaron?
Well, so I think the difference between nerddom and fandom has changed a lot in the last 20 years. What we've seen, especially with kind of the renaissance of the internet, is that where you used to have a lot of barriers to entry to fandom, where it used to be a lot harder to become a fan if you were a fan of, say, classic Golden Age murder mysteries or 1950s science fiction, finding other people to be fans with was a lot harder. Whereas with the internet, you can pretty easily find a message board to talk about anything. So where those people kind of existed in isolation for so long, were viewed almost derisively as nerds, now it's a lot more commonplace, and there's a lot less nerddom stigma attached to fandom because pretty much everyone has that one thing they were a special fan of that they can now share with everyone else.
So I just got back from a long weekend, a vacation, a long adventure, and I picked up a pair of sunglasses. Everywhere I go, I pick up a pair of sunglasses. I will buy, you know, just to remind me of that location or something that I did. And I'm wondering if that falls into the definition of fandom, or is that just a collector of weird things, Zoe?
It actually very much would. We talk about the fan-like activities, these things that people can do that are above and beyond just interacting with a fan object. So that's things like taking pilgrimages to some place, going somewhere just for the meaning of it, not necessarily because it's a pretty place, or going someplace for the importance of that location. Content creation, making things almost in tribute to a fan object, and you can do things like making rituals and traditions and evangelizing to other people about it and socializing with fellow fans. But one of the most showy of fan-like activities is making collections of things, which is to say you're buying things not necessarily for the primary purpose. It's not as if the sun has just suddenly gotten super bright, so you need hundreds of pairs of sunglasses. Buying things for the joy of ownership, for that feeling of being able to control it, almost as if it's like a fetish object, being able to feel close to these things, and maybe by definition, by proxy, being close to the things that they represent. So perhaps every time you see these sunglasses, they remind you of the place where you bought them.
And that's exactly what they do, yeah. So is there some, are there super fans of Squishable? I'm not super familiar with your crowdsourced toy company, Squishable.
So there are. So Squishable, we sell giant round fuzzy stuffed animals, and we've been around for about a decade. And fairly soon after we started the company, we started seeing people on our Facebook page posting questions about the company or even starting to post their own collections, like your sunglasses. Mm-hmm. And what we found, and part of what motivated us to write this book, is that our super fans have actually started shaping the company in a lot of ways we didn't expect. And we have fans of Squishables who actually have gone through and posted pictures of every Squishable we've ever made, to the point where we actually found ones that we had forgotten making years and years ago. And they've gone through and tracked down that and created an encyclopedia of Squishables on our Facebook page.
Almost like, for example, the Beanie Baby craze, where people mm-hmm. always bought that kind of thing. So interesting, very interesting. So they want to own every single Squishable.
Or they don't even necessarily need to own every Squishable. They want to feel connected to Squishable, and this is one of the activities they can do to do it. So we actually have significantly more fans than have actually bought Squishables. And a lot of people will come on our Facebook page or onto the site, and they will draw a picture of the Squishable they want. Or we hear stories of people who come back time and time again to visit the the webpage of their Squishable, even if they haven't owned it yet. Because there's something in the emotional connectedness to the product that they very much appreciate. And they want to be able to kind of use their own activities to connect themselves to it, even if they don't own a Squishable or every one of the Squishables.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org if you have a question or a thought about super fandom. Do you consider yourself a fan or a super fan of anything? Do you think there's anything wrong with being a super fan? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about organized fandom and super fandom. I've been now for 32 years a member of Sons of the Desert, the International Laurel and Hardy Society.
Oh, cool. So how did that happen?
In my case, well, somebody started a chapter locally. The organization itself has existed for more than 50 years. It started in New York, and Orson Bean, the actor and the comedian, was one of the founders. And we're simply a group that gathers together every so often, once a month in general, to watch Laurel and Hardy and laugh our darn fool heads off.
So tell us, I mean, Jeff, talk a little bit about why you're such a fan of Laurel and Hardy, so much so that you're a part of this this organization.
Well, I suppose I grew up with them on television, and that had something to do with it. I'm beginning to think that my own value to the group locally is that I still know how to run the old 16-millimeter projectors.
Oh, there you go.
But there are fans and there are super fans in our group. There are some who show up wearing the Shriner-type fezes that Laurel and Hardy wore in Sons of the Desert, and some who show up wearing Laurel and Hardy-style derbies. And there are some super fans from other chapters. There's a chapter in Minneapolis, and I don't want to mention this gentleman's name because I'm sorry to say that he passed on recently after a long illness, but a couple of years ago he bid and won in an auction and paid something like $5,000 for a set of actual suits worn by Laurel and Hardy in one of their films.
Well,
that's a super fan.
Yeah, that is a super fan, and certainly sorry for his loss, but it is an example of, you know, buying maybe at great expense some clothing worn by the object of your fandom. And talk some about this. Maybe Aaron first on the here. Jeff is a, you know, kind of an organizing member of this society to promote and or laugh at Laurel and Hardy films.
Well, first off, Jeff, I think that's a fantastic organization, and I have to learn more about it because that's exactly what we talk about in the book. And one of what I think Jeff talked about that's so interesting is this concept of having grown up with it. And a lot of what we find is that fandom is very intimately tied with nostalgia. It's this looking back at a time where things were simpler or easier, or we felt a lot more secure in who we were. And we often find that fandoms are attached to the things we experience there. That's often, I think, why you see a lot of Disney fans be so hardcore into Disney, in that it represents a thing we learned in our childhood. And I think now with this resurgence of Star Wars and Marvel and a lot of the comic books, it's Zoe and my generation's nostalgia. It's the things we grew up with as we were young coming back, and we're reassociating our fandoms with those because it represents a lot simpler time in our lives and something that we feel very happy and emotionally positive about.
Yeah. Zoe, anything to add?
Well, I think the examples of buying the clothing are fantastic. Being able to, we call it impersonation, being able to almost embody some of these fan objects by wearing the trappings of them is a really powerful way. You're literally using the body as a canvas to kind of declare your allegiance to these things. And it's true that people can go all out. You see lots of, you know, cosplay is the term for, you know, wearing very, very complicated outfits to recreate characters or people that we feel close to. But We also could see it in simply as wearing a logo on a hat or a shirt. It doesn't actually have to go the full Elvis to get the complete experience of feeling close to something by wearing something like that. So I think that's a great example.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. You know, I met someone recently who will make her own costumes and costumes for other people. And it seems to me it is Disney-related, like, you know, the Elsa from Frozen or other characters. And they'll go to conventions and be all dressed up. And I'm not sure what happens at the convention, but that is that's another super fandom trend, isn't it, Zoe?
Absolutely. And Disney in itself, as Aaron says, is such a special example because there's such a huge population. But also one where there hasn't actually been much of a stigma against it in the past. Everyone wants to make fun of comics fans, but very few people are going to make fun of a Disney fan. So because it's safely mainstream, a lot of people feel comfortable dressing up as Belle, where they won't necessarily dress up as, you know, Spider-Man. So we see the cosplay aspect, where people go very all out. We also see there's an interesting phenomenon that's going on for the last couple of years called Disney bounding, which is since adults are dissuaded from dressing up as Disney characters to go to the actual parks themselves because of potential for confusion between what's an official character and what's not. There are lots of adults who will Disney bound, it's a verb, which is to say you put together outfits which are reminiscent of a character but aren't actually the character itself. So, for example, a blue T-shirt and a dark blue skirt and maybe a big red bow for the hair, and now you're Snow White.
Yeah. We are talking with Zoe Fraud-Blanar and Aaron Glazer. They are co-authors of the book Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. The book actually comes out tomorrow. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question or an example you'd like to share, or you can also email us ideas@wpr.org. So are you a super fan of anything? What is it and why? Or do you know someone who is? Let us know. So I'm not really familiar with this, but this is the song Secret Police. And apparently we are listening to a Japanese star, Hatsune Miku. And her entire life has been created by fans. Zoe, tell us about that.
Hatsune Miku, yes, she is 16 years old. She is a pop star in Japan. She is extremely popular, one of the biggest celebrities. She is a computer program. She is not a real person. She is a piece of software which can take fans' vocal ideas, their lyrics, their tunes, and sing them in a voice which sounds mostly human. And she is one of the most popular celebrities. She has toured with Lady Gaga. She was on Letterman in hologram form, of course. And she's a really interesting example of a fan-made celebrity. She is created by her fans. All of the songs she sings were made by her fans. There are hundreds of thousands of them on YouTube and iTunes. The art, we know what she looks like because fans draw her. And she's a great example of what a celebrity could be like if they were literally crowdsourced, if everything that they did, if everything that they felt and thought was created by the fans and controlled by the fans.
Oh, so, Aaron, talk a little bit more about you know, the fans creating this. What does it mean to I guess, surrender ownership to the audience? Is this a good thing?
It is, especially in this case. It's a very hard line to walk. But what Krypton Future Media, who founded Hatsune Miku, have done is they were actually trying to sell a piece of software. It's a software called Vocaloid software, and it's almost like using a synthesizer. But instead of synthesizing music, you're synthesizing vocals. And they had founded Hatsune Miku as kind of this character to help them sell the software. And once they put her out there, they discovered that she had taken on a life of her own. And it's a very difficult thing for an owner to let go of because there's a lot of potential for misuse. Hatsune Miku, if you go Google her, you will find a lot of X-rated material that people have created on the web. And she also sings a lot of controversial songs. She sings the song you were just playing was called Secret Police, and it's about an authoritarian regime controlling its population. That's not something you expect from a 16-year-old pop star. But in effect, she's created and become so incredibly popular just because her fans can do what they want. And Krypton Future Media has created and let them run loose with it within reasonable bounds. And out what's come out of that is this incredibly popular star that a lot of Japan loves. She's been a spokesman for Google and for Domino's Pizza and for Toyota. And she's allowed fans to connect in a way with a pop star that they otherwise wouldn't get the opportunity to do. It's almost as if you could write songs for Lady Gaga and she would sing them directly to you, which is something you don't really get in the outside world.
So, Zoe, what are the core things that must be done in order to create a fandom?
Creating a fandom is difficult. In hindsight, it's very easy to look back and say, oh, those were that was the situation that allowed the fandom to grow. But fandom is an emergent behavior, which is to say, while it's happening, there's no way to know which way it's going to go. The best that you can do is create the fertile ground for it and just pray it's going to grow. So the fertile ground, as Aaron mentioned earlier, there is that concept of having the three main things you need. You need to have a platform. You need to have a minimum viable group. You need to have enough emotional response. After that, things get a little bit more complicated. Certainly, once you have a core group of people, you need to have a way to keep things interesting for them before you hit that minimum viable group. Without having a big group to act in and having the fun of being part of a big group, you need to kind of almost fake that in a way, perhaps through over-the-top shows of affection and approval. It's called love bombing. It's actually a turn from culting. Really, really showing people that they're appreciated, that they're needed until there's enough people to start showing that to each other. So that's definitely one thing. Picking the fan-like activities that people can do to feel like they're part of the group, especially ones that let people show their status, that's very core. So, for example, letting someone show off how hardcore of a fan they are, showing off their collections, showing off what great artists they are, perhaps making art in tribute. And then there's always, more subtle things that can be done. Drawing a line between insiders and outsiders. It's unfortunately very effective being able to say, we within this group, we're better than those other people. This is great for sports fandom. There's nothing like a good rivalry to make you really feel like a sports fan of a particular team.
We are talking with Zoe Fraud-Blanner and Aaron Glazer, co-authors of Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. So do you have an obsession? Does it change what you buy and who you are? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No, I am your father.
Star Wars fans certainly will recognize that clip from Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, where Darth Vader says he is Luke's father. We are talking about fans and super fans this hour with our two guests who are co-authors of the book Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and who we are. We're welcoming your questions, your own examples. Are you a fan or a super fan of something? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our guests are Zoe Fraud-Blonner and Aaron Glazer. They are both with the crowdsourced toy company Squishable. And Zoe is a faculty member of New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program and NYU Journalism. So, Zoe, is there a difference between Star Wars fans and Harry Potter fans, for example?
Yes and no. There certainly is a difference between the type of people who might be drawn to Star Wars and might be drawn to Harry Potter. It's very different, you know, in terms of kind of what would speak to people for each of those. But the motivations are the same. So while it's true that someone who's maybe at a point in their lives where they want excitement and they want to feel grown up and they want to, feel associated with a fan object that stands for rebellion and exploring the world, they might be more drawn to Star Wars. Perhaps someone who's looking for community and maybe battling some inner demons, they might be more drawn to Harry Potter. But that need to connect with a group, to connect with something that's going to help them feel like a better version of themselves, that's universal. That's something very, very human, right back to our core of what makes culture.
Let's go back to the phones. Ed in West Allis is with us now. Hi, Ed.
Good morning.
Morning.
First, I want to say the best baseball fans in North America are the Brooklyn Dodger fans for our love of the team and Ebbets Field. The greatest literary fans are those of the only author worth reading, James Joyce, because every June 16th, we double the size of Dublin. We start out at Sandy Cove at Martello Tower and intone Intro Ibo ad Altari Dei, the opening words of Ulysses, and then we end up at 7 Exhall Street. It was the home of Leopold Bloom and Molly, unfortunately demolished, though the door is now at the James Joyce Museum in Dublin, but we end up at 2 a.m. in the morning reading the soliloquy from Chapter 18, Molly's soliloquy. So we do the whole day. We go all throughout Dublin. And as I say, the only person worth... And right now, I think a first edition copy of Ulysses is selling for $200,000 to $225,000 American.
Wow. Do you want to react first, Aaron?
Sure. Well, I think part of what Ed is talking about is the importance of rituals in any form of fandom, which is the annual day where every day you have thousands and thousands of people once a year coming out to support James Joyce is an amazing exhibition of fan rituals and of things that bring everyone together. And that's why we talk about fandom not being able to exist in isolation. It's very easy to love James Joyce and to read all of James Joyce's novels, but to actually be a fan, you need to be out participating in some form of communal activity like the events they do once a year. It's also important to talk about kind of this extremism in fandom. Everyone thinks their fandom is the best. And that's actually very important because it sets up your fandom and really ties you to how important that fandom is to you as a person and to how much of a part of your own identity fandom is. And being able to say we are the best and ours is the only fandom that matters is something that lets you feel like you've made the right decisions and that your fandom is the one that very much represents your own personal morals and values.
And what did Ed dropped off, so I forgot. Was it the Brooklyn Dodgers fans are the best?
Brooklyn Dodgers.
Do you agree with that or not?
I would have to say I'm a Yankees fan these days, but I'm not sure I say that on the air very often.
Well, how about those Cub fans, though, too? They go through decades and decades and decades of disappointment, and then they're finally rewarded. So I guess that there's that as well. Let's go back to the phones. Oh, I'm sorry. I should address, because I'm sure the super fans of Star Wars are going to know I misspoke. We had a typo, and I said that that clip I played was from, I think I said episode 4, but it was episode 5. I want to be accurate in that. Randy in Madison is with us. Hi, Randy.
Hi. You must have raised the ire of every nerd in the state. My nephew is a jazz musician and producer, and he's a huge fan of Miles Davis, and he named his son Davis. So when I pointed out to him that old Miles not only admitted that he would like to beat up his last wife, Cicely Tyson, and several of his girlfriends, but bragged about it, he got mad at me. And I thought maybe he could have saved some of that resentment for Miles Davis himself. All of which is by way of saying, I think we tend to cling to our fandom long after we should have let go of it. And I think the perfect touchstone would be Bill Cosby. I'm sure that there's plenty of people who were thinking all those lying sluts were trying to get him in trouble. Until the reality set in.
Brandy, thank you very much. Zoe, what about when the object of our fandom maybe isn't the stellar character we thought he or she was?
This is a very interesting situation, and one that actually comes up fairly often. Fandom is held together by the glue of authenticity, by our belief in the innate goodwill of the fan object or the people who own the fan object. We believe in the truth of it. That's the only reason why, as fans, we're willing to devote our souls to it, our time, our energy, our love. And this is very dangerous, because we're devoting ourselves to something we don't actually have full control over. As long as that unspoken agreement, that agreement that says we're going to ignore that these are real people and infallible people and real brands that have actual business imperatives, we're going to ignore that fact as long as people don't shove it in our faces. We'll pretend it doesn't exist. But at a certain point, that's not an option anymore. At a certain point, there are corporate decisions made that we deeply disagree with. It turns out that celebrities have hidden skeletons in the closet. And one of the reasons why people have such incredibly negative reactions when that happens is because it's part of themselves that are actually being betrayed. It's not as if, the local plumbing company has just, shown that they had subpar working conditions. When it's, say, Nike, we really feel it. Because this is more than just the local plumbing company. This is a brand that we've made part of ourselves. And that's true especially for celebrities. These people are human. They have their own lives. There's a great term, pseudo-human events, which is kind of the the academic term for what celebrities actually are. They're not actually humans. They're kind of a mix of rumors and fashion tips and political opinions and the media they make and the news that they create. And there may or may not actually be a real person in there somewhere. So when we have to be reminded of that person and the fallibility and to remember their fallible humanity, it really strikes us at a chord that's so much deeper than if we were just consumers.
Matt on Facebook says, I find this subject so depressing. Putting all this energy into cataloging and celebrating the total domination of marketing and advertising of our social consciousness is highly distressing to me. All these superfans could be creating their own identities, independent of products and media sensations, by feeding the hungry, making art or music, or growing a garden. Is this what we have come to, a nation of superfans? What do you think of that, Aaron?
So I actually think that, he's not wrong. We should absolutely be feeding the homeless and making the world a better place. But what we've actually found is that what fandom has done has replaced a lot of those community organizations that don't exist anymore. And it's allowed fandom to be the things that feed the homeless. So we have this great story in the book about a group of Harry Potter fans that set out to attack basically how Warner Brothers was producing chocolate. Chocolate production, especially overseas, is a very distressing industry where there's a lot of slavery, where chocolate beans are collected and produced by young underage laborers. And the Harry Potter fans felt like this wasn't something that lived in association and was what Harry Potter would have wanted, the fictional character, mm-hmm. or what J.K. Rowling would have wanted. And they actually went out of their way and waged a battle with Warner Brothers to make sure that any Harry Potter-themed chocolates, and they make chocolate frogs and they sell them at the theme parks and in stores, was done using fair trade labor. And they've actually set themselves up as a kind of a new community organization to fight on behalf of the things they believe in. And they found that Harry Potter has brought with it a set of kind of morals and standards for what they value. And they're using that as their approach to the world and trying to make the world a better place.
Ah, interesting. Let's go next to Bruce in Burlington. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. How are you? I'm a fan of baby metal. And I think sometimes to the annoyance of friends and family, but I want to thank...
What is baby metal, Bruce?
Baby metal is a Japanese pop trio.
Okay.
And they have a huge fandom all across the world. Millions of people, yet a lot of people like yourself haven't heard of them.
Right.
So I'm definitely a fan. And I want to thank Zoe and Aaron for kind of making me more aware of why I'm a baby metal fan. A lot of their music is about... being inclusive and welcoming others, we're all one, that kind of thing, and I really think that does kind of resonate with my own moral compass.
Wonderful, thank you for sharing that, Bruce. Zoe, your reaction?
I myself am actually a baby metal fan, so I could not agree more.
Very nice.
You know, Mindy on Facebook says, my husband and I started collecting comic books together when we were first started dating. Now my toddler son's room is superhero themed, and we frequent comic cons. Other things I have been a super fan are Star Wars, Marvel Comics, feminist authors, collecting vintage toys, comics since I was a kid, dinosaurs. Now my toddler loves dinosaurs, and this has been, we have a resurgence in our house. I bring this one up last because we're almost out of time. It sounds like that we can pass down our super fandom. What's the future of super fandom, Aaron?
We definitely can. There's this theory of social first fandom, which is that you kind of come to fandom based on the social group and enthusiasts you happen to be surrounding yourself by. So that can be how I would imagine a lot of people become Wisconsin Badgers fans, is that their family and friends are fans. So our fandom, just like our religion and our culture and our general community spirit, is passed down from generation to generation, and it's also shared among the community in which we live. And I think that's a very good thing.
Yeah, and do you have a 30-second takeaway for us, Zoe?
I agree. I think that the longer that people feel comfortable sharing fandoms, the less stigmatized they become. I really think that the future is bright here.
Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Zoe Fraud Blonner and Aaron M. Glazer are the co-authors of Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. Thank you to Brianne Chasso for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. And I hope you join us tomorrow at this time. We will be talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And it is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.